While many species are going extinct, some are thriving in the human-built environment, like giant catfish and their new prey, pigeons.
It's a new kind of ecological interaction between catfish and pigeons, neither of which are native to that city. They've both been brought together by humans. We have introduced them to each other, and it's turned out that one can eat the other, and it's learned a way to do that. And that's really, I think, one of the major evolutionary forces in cities, that you have these species that are introduced to each other by us and that start using each other.
That's Menno Skiltausen. We talk with him about his book, Darwin Comes to Town, out from Picador Press. Then we talk to a modern-day Indiana Jones who travels the planet to witness the impact of climate change.
I consider myself an explorer, really. I explore parts of the world that are undergoing these extreme transitions. It's kind of the job description that you dream up when you're 8 years old, and then you eventually grow out of it, I suppose. I never really grew out of it.
That's adventurer and documentarian George Carunas. We talk with him about the revival of his TV series, Angry Planet, on KCET and Link TV. That's all coming up on Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rianni. The world observes Earth Day each year on April 22nd. It's the day we celebrate the environment that gives us life and sustenance. I don't know about you, but as I contemplate where we are today, I find little to celebrate and much to grieve as the Trump administration tries its hardest to undo 50 years of environmental protection and more than 100 years of conservation. But there are some things to celebrate. In spite of the overall toll that human activity is taking on the health of the planet, there are some species that are thriving within the human-built environment. My guest, evolutionary biologist Menno Skiltausen, has been studying the endless diversity of life since he was a little boy collecting bugs in his backyard in the Netherlands. That backyard is long gone now, replaced by an urban jungle that, surprisingly, may be even more biodiverse than the Dutch countryside. And that's a phenomenon he's observed all over the world. As cities take up more of our planet, many animal species are evolving to adapt, like mosquitoes on the London Underground who only bite humans, or coyotes who find plenty of prey in our urban parks, or like those giant catfish dining on pigeons. And as a big mammal species ourselves, we may be evolving as urban animals too. Skiltausen explores this development in his fascinating new book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Menno Skiltausen is an ecologist and evolutionary biologist based at Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden, the Netherlands, and holds a chair in evolution at Leiden University. Well, Menno Skiltausen, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
Your book, Darwin Comes to Town, is about how life is evolving on an urban planet, and you start the book with a mosquito. But as you say in the book, not just any mosquito, but the London Underground mosquito. I didn't even know there was a London Underground mosquito. Why did you start there?
Well, it's the London Underground mosquito is a species of mosquito that does not only occur in the London Underground. It occurs in underground places all over the world. And it is a species that probably has evolved only when people started building underground spaces to live in or to commute in. And this has happened, you know, in the past few hundred, maybe few thousand years. It has become a new species of mosquito that only bites people, that mates in a different way, that has a different lifestyle. And as all these evolutionary changes have happened, since this species split off from an above-ground species that doesn't bite people, and only thanks to the fact that we have modified our environment in such a way that there's a place for these new mosquitoes to find a niche and to survive. So it's, I think it's a very good, very close-to-home example of how we have an impact on the animals and plants that live with us, and we steer their evolution.
Yeah, you say that human actions are actually the world's single most influential ecological force. In fact, some people call this era the Anthropocene. Talk about the urbanization of our planet and how that has made humans have such a powerful impact.
Well, it's really the first time in the history of the Earth that a single species has been able to modify and to influence the Earth's ecosystem in such a dramatic way. There's no other. I mean, there have been periods, of course, when organisms like the dinosaurs had a big ecological role, but that's like a whole class of animals, thousands of species, and we are just a single species, and we're doing all this. So we're now appropriating a quarter of all the food that is produced by all of the world's plants. So we play an extremely central role in the global ecosystem. Everything that goes on in this world is somehow influenced by us. And places where these influences reach a pinnacle are our cities and other urbanized areas. That's where all those changes that we enforce on the environment, climate change, pollution, noise, removal of natural vegetation, and so on and so forth, come together. And that's also the areas where it seems or it turns out that other organisms are adapting rapidly and pervasively to the way we change their environment.
You know, I think a lot of people talk about the distinction between the built environment and the natural environment. But you say in this book, Darwin Comes to Town, you say that human cities are a fully natural phenomenon. In other words, that we are part of nature. Well, of course, we're part of nature, not separate from it. But human cities are a part of nature?
Well, it is something that we do. We are a species, just like any other. I mean, we're an unusual species, but we're in a sort of a biological sense no different from any other large mammal species. And we just happen to have this tendency to live in large groups and to build structures in which we can live, just like beavers do, for example. They also build structures for their own benefit, and they modify their environment. And humans have been doing this, of course, for as long as we've been around, and it's only recently that those villages have stopped being villages and have become cities. But still, I think it's in our nature, so it is natural. And the result is that other organisms find niches in those structures that we build, in those big conglomerations that we call cities, just like there are thousands of different species of animals that live inside ants' nests, for example, or inside termites' nests. So I think if you look at it in a sort of biological, objective way, yes, we are part of nature, and the things we do, like building cities, is a natural phenomenon, and so is the evolution of flora and fauna in cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you call us ecosystems engineers, and you talk in your book a little bit about the Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project talks about New York as it was in 1609, when beavers and humans were the ecosystems engineers. What struck me when I went to the website of the Manhattan Project was the incredible diversity of species, plant and animal, back in 1609. What kind of diversity of species do we have in the urban environment?
Yeah, those natural biodiversities have, some of it has survived. You still find some of the mammals, some of the plants, some of the birds that were living in Manhattan before it was colonized by Europeans. And they're still surviving in parks and even on the streets of New York. But most of them can no longer survive in the city. And at the same time, some of those species that have disappeared are being replaced by by species from elsewhere in the world. Cities are places where you do see some local species surviving, but it's really a subset of species that have some kind of predisposition that allows them to survive in cities. But in addition, cities are also places where humans, either intentionally or accidentally, bring in a lot of species of animals and plants from all over the world. So when you look at the biodiversity of New York City, for example, you do find a number of native species, but you also find a lot of introduced species like starlings, like rock pigeons, various weeds and trees, which have been brought in by people. And that seems to be a sort of a general trend in cities worldwide, that there's a sort of a homogenization going on of the flora and fauna, and these species that are well adapted to cities are traveling all over the world and they're colonizing new cities. So you really have a global ecosystem which consists to some extent of local species, but also to a large extent of species from other parts of the world.
On the other hand, you also point to a kind of very surprising diversification of species in cities. For example, the mice in Central Park are different than the mice in, let's say, Prospect Park. And talk about how this kind of island phenomenon happens in cities to create more diversity.
Yeah, fragmentation is one of the hallmarks of urban ecology. You do see that vegetation, whether it's natural vegetation or artificial vegetation, is very much fragmented. Or actually any habitat for an animal or plant in the city is very much fragmented. So you have all these barriers between them that are, in the case of the white-footed mice that live in parks in New York, the barriers are the built environment and the roads, which they simply cannot cross. They need some forest cover to live. So that then also results in really like a sort of an island system, similar to natural islands in the sea, similar to the Galapagos, where you find that species adapt to the local conditions of each island. And you see the same thing happening in those fragments of vegetation in the city. For example, those white-footed mice, which are a native species, they've always lived in that area, and they are surviving in parks, in Central Park and in Prospect Park and other parks. They adapt to the specific characteristics of the park. So Central Park, for example, is visited by 25 million people per year. It's the most heavily visited park in New York, and that results in an abundance of junk food and snacks and scraps of pizza crusts and breadcrumbs that are in the park, and these mice are surviving on that. So researchers like my colleague Jason Munchie South of Fordham University, they're discovering that the genes of those mice are adapting to that fatty diet, so a very different diet from what they're used to. And so they're in the chromosomes, there are adaptations taking place which help them to digest this kind of food.
So they're not getting type 2 diabetes and cancer from the diet?
Well, they might, but even that then results in sort of a natural selection that helps their physiology to cope with these new diseases that they're facing because of a change in diet. So they won't go extinct because of it, but probably there are changes in their physiology, sort of genetic changes, which help them to cope with the disadvantages of, but also the advantages of changing what food they take.
So talk now about the mechanism of urban evolution, because I think most of us, and I certainly myself, I thought that evolution was a much slower process, and that before evolution could, you know, really get to work, you know, species are going extinct.
Yeah, evolution can be a very slow process. It depends a bit on what you call evolution. A sort of a biologist's definition would be any change in an organism's genetics over time. So even a change in a proportion of a certain gene in a population would already be called evolution. But of course, all those changes accumulate over time to make the really big changes that usually people think of when you talk about evolution. But the smaller changes, like what we see in those white-footed mice, they can take place over very short timescales, decades, for example. especially if you have a species that has a very short generation time. So humans, of course, are a relatively slowly evolving species because it takes for us 20, 25 years before there's a new generation. And only in the next generation can you see the effects of the natural selection that was taking place in the previous generation. So that's sort of the evolutionary clock speed. And if that clock speed is higher, like in insects and small mammals, the evolution can also take place faster. Plus the fact that in cities, the environment changes so drastically that also the pressure to evolve is also greater. The benefits of being different or the disadvantage of being different are very great, and that results in very rapid changes. If there are mutations in the DNA that allow this, if there's no way for an animal to adapt, to evolve, to deal with the local new conditions, then they will go extinct. So really the flip side of all this urban evolution is indeed extinction of species that cannot adapt and that disappear.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with evolutionary biologist Menno Schildhausen about his book, Darwin Comes to Town. Now, you say that these days, actually, many urban centers are ecological oases compared with the surrounding countryside, the rural countryside. Why is that?
Yeah, it's surprising that we tend to think that cities are poor in biodiversity, and that if you go out of the city, you find much higher diversity, you find rich flora and fauna, and that's actually the way it was in the past. But it seems that the past few decades, tables have been turned. I think it's one very telling example is that if you look at the titles of field guides, of books written about nature, for example, in and around New York, then up until the 1950s, you find that the titles are the birds in the vicinity of New York or the mosses around New York. So people really were using the city as a basis to explore the biologically much more interesting hinterland. And then from the 1950s, 1960s onwards, suddenly you see titles of books appearing, the birds of New York and the plants in New York City. And it seems that this has to do with, on the one hand, agricultural intensification. So the countryside is no longer this sort of romantic mixture of small-scale habitats and ponds and rows of trees and places where a lot of different animals and plants can find a niche and be free of any kind of persecution and pesticides and herbicides. Because there's much more optimization of agricultural production, there's less space for wildlife in the countryside. And at the same time, cities are becoming greener, more and more green roofs and green walls and gardens and city parks are being created. And they're also being created in an ecologically sensible way. People are no longer just planting geometric patterns of trees. They're really making little miniature habitats in cities, in their gardens, but also in parks. So that's creating more niches in cities for wildlife. So we're really seeing a change that the biodiversity of cities is going up and the biodiversity of the countryside, at least in Europe and North America and parts of Asia, is unfortunately going down.
You argue for what you call a pragmatic approach to conservation. What is that approach? What kind of urban design does promote ecosystems health in cities, aside from what you've just spoken about?
Well, I think if we're aware of the fact that animals and plants are evolving to adapt to urban conditions, then we should make use of those already adapted species. There's still a tendency for people who plan green spaces in city to design not just the way these areas look, but also what grows there. So species are picked out of a catalog, to especially among plants, of course, to stock these parks with, or these green roofs or these green walls or these sort of green architectural projects. I would say, why not use the species that are already in the city growing wild and being very successful at dealing with urban conditions, and simply allow those species to colonize the spaces that you create for them? So rather than planting plant species in a park or on a green roof, simply provide the space, the soil if necessary, but basically leave it bare and leave it for animals and plants that are already in the city to colonize them under their own steam. And many of those species will be non-native species. They will be introduced species that are just very good at living in a city. But I think those are the ones that really we should rely on for building a healthy urban ecosystem.
So going back to some of this evolution, you say that urban species, are different in their behavior, and you think that this is a genetic thing, more streetwise, if I can use that pun, than their rural counterparts. What qualities do urban species have that make them more adaptable to urban life?
It differs. It depends on what kind of animal or plant you're talking about.
So going back to some of this evolution, you say that urban species are different in their behavior, and you think that this is a genetic thing, more streetwise, if I can use that pun, than their rural counterparts. What qualities do urban species have that make them more adaptable to urban life?
Yes, if you're really looking at mammals and birds, you do see that some species are good at living in cities, had some sort of predisposition. But the changes that you see taking place in their behavior as they adapt to cities really have to do with an evolution of their personality. So outside of the cities, for example, it's usually, or evolution has caused these species to become, to be shy and to be wary of anything unusual. So they usually don't approach new objects. The way they get food is usually very predictable, so they don't need to deal with any new ways of finding food. But in the city, all those qualities actually are negative qualities. So you see that in the city, actually, for many birds and mammals, it's better to be curious, to approach new objects because they might contain food, to not to be afraid of humans because humans usually bring food and other opportunities. So many researchers have been doing experiments on these personality characteristics of bird species, especially in the city and outside of the city. And then within the same species of bird, they find that the populations outside of the city, they are not curious, they are not very good at problem solving, they are not tolerant of people. And in the city, the same species of bird has a completely different personality. And those are really genetic differences, because you also see them when you bring young birds from the city and from the countryside and you grow them up in the lab under the same conditions. They still show those personality differences. So it's really something in the genes that are responsible for their psychology that have evolved in the city. And that's really a general phenomenon among urban birds.
We're talking with evolutionary biologist Menno Schildhausen about his book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. It's so interesting. Talking about urban birds, there's one case in which the birds are getting into some serious trouble in the cities, and they're getting into trouble from fish, enormous catfish. I went online to watch the videos of this. You have these catfish that are some, 5 and 6 feet long in a town in France, who are actually leaping out of the water and grabbing pigeons and eating them. It is amazing. Talk about the concept, the Red Queen concept that you talk about with this example.
Yeah, it's really amazing that these introduced catfish, which normally are supposed to live on crayfish and mollusks that they dig up from the bottom of the rivers, instead they've discovered that they can much more easily get food by grabbing bathing pigeons that are bathing on the riverside by their feet and pulling them underwater and eating them. So they've learned how to deal with a new kind of food. It's a new kind of ecological interaction between catfish and pigeons, neither of which are native to that city. They've both been brought together by humans. We have introduced them to each other, and it's turned out that one can eat the other, and it's learned a way to do that. And that's really, I think, one of the major evolutionary forces in cities, that you have these species that are introduced to each other by us and that start using each other usually as food, that one species eats another species. A new insect feeds on a plant, or in this case, a fish feeds on a bird. And then you get a situation where evolution in both ways is possible. So in the case of the fish and the rock pigeons, it could be that the catfish is evolving to be better at catching those pigeons, and the pigeons are evolving to stay out of the way of the catfish. So you really have two moving targets in an evolutionary interaction, which usually works in a very dramatic way, in a very fast way.
And that's what you call the Red Queen, because they're running fast to stay in the same place. You know, the Netherlands is perhaps the most densely populated country in Europe, and human domination has been a major feature of life there, since the year 900 or something.
Yeah.
Ever since the Dutch began reclaiming their land from the sea. Do you think that influenced your perspective?
Maybe. It is, of course... Yeah, it's very hard to find wild nature in the Netherlands. It's almost impossible, really. Everything is influenced by people to some extent. And yet the Netherlands is really a place where there is a lot of nature studies, probably one of the best studied countries in the world in terms of wild biodiversity. So everybody who's interested in biology, in nature, in the Netherlands is constantly... Yeah, doing some form of urban ecology, or at least ecology in the context of habitats that are very much influenced by people. So I think that probably plays a role.
And then you have places that have been reclaimed. Lelystad, is that?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, around that area, there's a very large reclaimed region that has sort of naturally, because it was left unattended for a while, it has developed into a swamp, which is very similar to the swamps we probably used to have in the Netherlands before humans were living here. And then, after that, people have started introducing these large herbivores there, which some people say were a phenomenon of Northern Europe for a long time, until people started hunting them. And it's still a bit of a debate whether that's really the case. But we now have a sort of an ecosystem there that is very rich in herbivores and birds. And yet it's something that is only a few decades old.
Yeah. I've been there. So talk a little bit about the impact of pollutants, urban pollutants, as a driver of evolution in the city.
Yeah, chemical pollutants, but also things like light and sound pollution, of course, are important factors in the changed habitat in cities. We really concentrate a lot of chemical compounds wherever we are, and they are released even... If we try to curb it, they are released at relatively high concentrations wherever we are living. Animals and plants evolve to deal with that. There are plants which evolve an ability to tolerate heavy metals. There are fish that evolve an ability to tolerate, for example, high concentrations of salt, which are released by road salting in the winter, but also high concentrations of PCBs, which were a major pollutant, especially in the second half of the 20th century. And even the familiar city pigeons, which we see everywhere in the city, they are evolving to adapt to the high density of zinc and lead that you find in cities. And they do that by putting it in their feathers. You see in cities that you have these city pigeons with dark plumage, are much more common than outside of cities, and that has to do with the fact that the melanin in those feathers is better at binding at atoms of zinc and lead, so they can really detox their bodies by simply putting it in their dark feathers.
So you refer to the biologist E.O. Wilson. He has an argument that we should leave half the earth wild. What do you think of this argument?
That would be great if that were possible. I'm not sure if we're already beyond that that borderline. But I think it's, I do, even though I I think we should study and value what's going on in cities where you see these urban ecosystems evolving. At the same time, we cannot rely on cities for the conservation of the majority of biodiversity. It's really a small subset of species that can live there. So I fully agree with you, Wilson, that we need wild places just as well to preserve the majority of the world's existing biodiversity, and especially the species that cannot survive in habitats that are very much impacted by humans. So I think that's, if at all possible, and it's actually a bit similar to what you see on a small scale in some countries where concessions are given for developments, which then specifies that half of that concession should be left untouched. There's the Amazon, for example, when they were opening up the Amazon region for cattle farming, the concessions that were given there were always for only half of, or the concession that was given could only be used for 50% for cattle farming, the rest needed to remain forest. So I think that sort of system allows for natural habitats to be maintained and areas to be developed. So if you would apply that on the scale of the Earth, it might also work.
Well, this has just been a fascinating conversation, Menno Schildhausen. Your book is Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Well, thanks very much. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Evolutionary biologist Menno Schildhausen. In addition to Darwin Comes to Town, he's the author of three other popular science books, including Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. Read an excerpt from Darwin Comes to Town at writersvoice.net. Next up, what one global adventurer is finding out about climate change. Stay tuned after the break.
Flow, glancing, dancing, see the water flow. Oh, wizard of changes, water, 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 dark or silvery, mother of life, water, water, holy mystery, heaven's daughter, wizard of changes, teach me the lesson of flowing. God made a song when the world was new. Water's laughter sings it through. Wizard of changes, teach me the lesson of flowing.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My next guest, Canadian explorer and storm chaser George Karunas, traveled the globe as the host of the Angry Planet TV series. In its 49 episodes, he got up close with the most violent and spectacular forces on Earth, from tornadoes to hurricanes to volcanoes and more. Now he's back with a revival of Angry Planet, this time reporting back from the front lines of climate change. As Earth heats up, natural disasters are becoming more frequent and severe. In a call to action for change, the new series of Angry Planet asks us to step up and make a difference. It premiered on April 4th on KCET in Southern California and nationwide on Link TV. The episodes are being rolled out online, where you can see the first one, Rising Oceans. I called up George Karunas to find out more about the new Angry Planet. George Karunas, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've been doing the Angry Planet series. The original series was from 2006 to 2010. This is now 11 years later from the first season one. What kind of changes have you seen since the time that you started doing this terrific series?
Wow. I mean, in the past 10 years or so, I've had the wonderful opportunity to travel the world to about 65 different countries and visit a lot of places where there's extreme weather going on and extreme forces of nature. And one thing that I have noticed in that time, sort of differences that I've noticed, is the human impacts seem to be increasing. That could be a combination of things, denser populations. So when you have a natural disaster, you have more people that are affected. But what I'm seeing more and more of is these disasters that are being more and more linked to climate change. Like, for example, we were in Bangladesh and we had the opportunity to interview all of these families who had been displaced to Dhaka from the south because their land is simply gone. It no longer exists. They were pointing out to the ocean and saying that's where their farmland used to be and that land is not coming back. So we're seeing more and more people being affected now.
And when you started out, were you very aware of climate change?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. For me, it started off as an interest in science and nature and the weather, the natural world, things like that. So I started off pursuing tornadoes and then hurricanes and then into forest fires and volcanoes, all different forces of nature. But in the last season or so of the show, we really started to focus more on the bigger picture of climate and how things are changing, and things like melting permafrost in the Arctic and Siberia and rising sea levels in places like Tuvalu and the effects of drought on things like forest fires in the United States and in Australia, places like that.
And before we get into that, which is, of course, the main thing we want to focus on today, I just want to ask you, how did you get into doing this kind of adventure storm chasing?
I know. I consider myself an explorer, really. I explore parts of the world that are undergoing these extreme transitions. And it's kind of the job description that you dream up when you're 8 years old, and then you eventually grow out of it. I suppose I never really grew out of it. When I was a kid, my heroes were guys like Jacques Cousteau and Indiana Jones. So I always had this passion for adventure, but also a deep, deep love and curiosity for the natural world. And I just was able to make a bizarre career out of it.
And we are all so lucky that you did that. So now let's talk about the series. Episode 1 in the new season of the series Angry Planet takes place in Tuvalu, probably ground zero, if there ever is a ground zero for sea level rise. In fact, the episode is called Rising Oceans. First of all, tell us about Tuvalu. Where is it, and what did you find when you first got there?
Well, it's a tiny little speck in the Pacific that very few people ever visit. It's one of these low-lying island nations, and it just so happens that the day that we landed, they received the record rainfall that they've ever experienced in one day. So the entire island was flooded out, not so much from rising seas on this particular day, but from tremendous, tremendous rainfall. I can't even remember how much it was, but we talked to the meteorologists there, and they couldn't believe it. The entire airport runway was underwater shortly after we landed, so our timing was good. But the problem with Tuvalu is that they get these things called these king tides, and that's it's the highest tide of the year, and these are getting higher and higher. And what's happening is that seawater is infiltrating their drinking water, and it's damaging their crops and things like that. So there's concern from the people and the government of Tuvalu that their nation may soon become uninhabitable because of this saltwater intrusion that's happening.
Yeah, it really struck me. It's just really just a little slip of land. I mean, it's something like no inhabitant is further from the ocean than 400 yards. Is that right?
That sounds about right. Yeah, it's a tiny little speck, and there's a large runway on the island that was constructed during World War II. The Allies were using it as a staging point during the Pacific Theater versus the Japanese Imperial Army. And that's the largest feature on the island is the runway. And you can literally throw a stone in some parts from one side of the island to the other. And it's just a remarkable little place. And the thing about these little islands is that their carbon footprint is tiny. They barely contribute to climate change and adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, but yet they are the ones that are on the front lines. They're the ones that are going to be suffering the most and seeing the effects first.
You talked to many people there, but I think the most affecting interview was one that you did with a woman. I don't remember her name, but I know that she was close to tears as she was talking about what was happening to her homeland. It was toward the end of the episode. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about. She was this wonderful woman that we came across, and she was concerned about the future of her nation, her homeland, her family, her kids, her grandkids. And wherever I travel, these are the same sort of themes that come up. People are pretty much all the same wherever you go. They want to have a good future for their family and for their kids and for their grandkids. And this woman and the entire population of the whole country has so much uncertainty moving forward that it's heartbreaking to talk to some of these people.
You know, and I think a lot of people don't think of the implications. They may think about, okay, this is an environmental disaster that's happening, but it's also a cultural disaster. You sat down to a traditional meal, a traditional Tuvalan meal, something that future generations may not get to eat.
Yeah, exactly. That they may have to relocate the population to nearby Fiji, and their way of life may disappear, as we've seen so many cultures disappear for various reasons over the past few hundred years. It's really tragic. We lose cultures, we lose languages for various reasons, and in this particular case, because the island itself may become uninhabitable.
And what's happening to their food supply? And they can't grow crops so easily anymore because, as you said before, there is saltwater intrusion. What's that doing to their diet?
Well, it's becoming more and more difficult for them to grow their crops. So they're getting less of their sort of traditional indigenous, for lack of a better term, food. So they're relying more and more on imports, canned food, things coming in from Australia, from Fiji, things like that. So their diet is changing. And, of course, a people's food is very much a part of their culture. I mean, go to Italy, go to France, go to, any place, go to rural Myanmar. The food is very much a part of the identity of a people. And so they're lacking not only that cultural aspect, but just basic food security in general, which is something that we take for granted.
Right. I mean, it was just heartbreaking to see, on the one hand, the traditional meal that you were served with, banana leaves and all kinds of delicious looking foods. And then on the other hand, to see you go into a supermarket and just see all the canned processed food that was there.
Yeah, exactly. And there's very little evidence that points to the situation going to be getting any better in the near future.
So what are we talking about when we talk about sea level rise? How fast is the sea rising in places like Tuvalu?
It's very small at the moment, but the thing that we're talking centimeters right now, and it may not sound like much, but here's the thing, is that this is the beginning. And even if we were to completely halt all carbon emissions today, it would still take several decades before the effects are really going to be noticed, because there's a tremendous delay. It's kind of like trying to steer a ship. Imagine trying to steer a big tanker ship. You can turn the wheel, but it takes a while for that ship to start to move. And that's exactly what the issue is with climate change. So when we have melting ice in places like Antarctica and Greenland, where the water is pouring into the ocean, and you have the oceans themselves becoming warmer, and that actually causes a thing called thermal expansion. So the water itself takes up slightly more volume. So these are two forces that are working together to raise sea levels that there's no way to quickly steer this boat and reverse the course.
Right. And I think some scientists say that I've seen figures that say that the rate of sea level rise is actually accelerating. It's not just, you know, kind of a gentle curve upward.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. We're seeing an accelerated pace.
Now, you said before that you went to Siberia. What kind of climate change impacts are you seeing there?
Well, Siberia is the thing that really is one of the things that really worries me. It's a bit of a ticking time bomb. We chose to go there during the most challenging time of year, in the middle of winter. And we went to the coldest town in the world, Oymyakon, which has the Guinness World Record for being the coldest permanently inhabited place on planet Earth. And when we were there, they were having a bit of a heat wave. It was minus 40, a balmy minus 40. But along the way, we met up with several scientists who study permafrost. And of course, permafrost is that layer of ground that's below the surface that stays frozen year-round. It never thaws out. The problem is that it is thawing out. And because it's a mixture of soil and organic material, plants and grasses and things like that, as it thaws and decomposes, it releases a lot of methane gas. Methane is about slightly over 20 times more potent of a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is. So it's already melting faster. And if it melts further still, then a lot of us worry that it will create a runaway greenhouse effect, whereas that methane causes this sort of avalanche of a cycle, like a loop, if you will, of warming and thawing and warming and thawing and releasing more and more gas. So there's billions of tons of greenhouse gas locked in that permafrost right now.
Yeah, that's a positive feedback effect. So what would runaway climate change look like for us on planet Earth?
Well, I mean, if you want to look at an extreme example, just look at Venus. We don't know exactly when, but many, many, many years ago, Venus underwent a tremendous greenhouse process. It's a runaway greenhouse effect. And of course, it is unbearably hot. It's hot enough to melt lead. That is an extreme example. But what we're looking at here is we could see quite several degrees worth of warming in a relatively short period of time, depending upon how much of that permafrost actually does melt and thaw. The other big carbon sink, if you will, that I worry about is also in the oceans, where we have tremendous amounts of methane being released from the ocean. Methane doesn't last in the atmosphere nearly as long as carbon dioxide does, but it's much more potent. And of course, it adds up and adds up and adds up.
And then you talked about wildfires. As we know, this has been just a devastating wildfire season in California. Were you there during the wildfires?
I wasn't, but I'm very familiar with everything that went on in California this year.
So what's your thought about that? I mean, some people point to the fact that, well, those wildfires were so bad just because so many people live in areas that are susceptible to wildfire. And, you know, we haven't been kind of control. We haven't been letting small fires burn. So when the big fires happen, they're much worse. So talk about the different factors and how much of a role climate change is actually playing.
Right. Well, you touched on some really important things there. Letting smaller fires burn, that's important to try and clear out the fuel. Of course, as I mentioned before, we're dealing with denser populations. Here's the thing, is that a forest fire in and of itself is not a natural disaster. It is a natural phenomenon, as is a tornado, as is a hurricane, as is a volcano. They only become disasters when they affect human populations. It is us that defines whether these phenomena become disasters. And so, yes, by the virtue of urban sprawl into these areas, I mean, we had the same thing up here in Canada where I live in Fort McMurray 2 years ago. So it's as you have more buildings spread into these heavily forested areas, yeah, you run the potential for more fires. But also, on top of that, we're seeing stronger longer periods of drought that can be directly linked to climate change. And of course, drought dries out the vegetation, making it more prone to fire, when we were in Australia filming for the show, we were embedded with the firefighters there, and they experienced the worst fire that they've seen in 35 years in Adelaide, just outside of Adelaide. And it was dramatic to be in the middle of it and to be engulfed in smoke and have fire completely surrounding you. And for that to be happening in your home, I can't even imagine how terrifying it is to be in a neighborhood that's burning like that.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you live pretty north, Fort McMurray, that's way up there. Is the climate just going to get to be nice and balmy for you? I mean, are there going to be places, let's say, on the planet, like where you live, where people are going to have to go as a refuge?
Well, here's the thing. Some parts of the planet will get warmer. Some parts will get colder. It's all about changing the patterns, right? The long-term patterns. Weather is what you get. Climate is what you expect to get. And what we're seeing is longer and tougher droughts and floods. We're seeing changes in migratory patterns of animals, birds, fish, things like that. So some places will become much more hospitable, will be actually quite nice in the future, relatively speaking. But other places may become devastated due to droughts and floods and things like that. So it all sort of depends upon where you live and what your perspective is. But of course, nobody wants to see runaway greenhouse effect and catastrophic natural disasters.
Absolutely. I've actually been thinking for a while, maybe Norway is the place to go.
Norway is a great choice. It's one of my favorite countries. It's one of the places as a matter of fact, last time I was in Norway, I was invited to speak at the United Nations Environmental Emergencies Forum. So I was actually able to share with delegates from all over the world some of my firsthand experience of documenting natural disasters and climate change. So that was, it's funny that you mentioned that. It's a really important nation when it comes to that. And it's one of those places that is naturally beautiful, has a high standard of living, and they will probably be one of the least affected nations by climate change.
Although we do have to point out that they're one of the producers of it because it's a nation that depends on oil.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One thing that did stand out to me when I first arrived in Norway, it was the number of Teslas that I saw. They're embracing electric cars like nowhere else that I've ever seen.
Well, that's good. So in terms of this series, how many do you plan? How many seasons are planned with this new series?
Oh, well, there are 10 new episodes that are airing that are going to be broadcast there. And then as moving forward in the future, we'll see. Right now, we don't have immediate plans to make any more. But I've been surprised many times when making this show. So who knows? I love making it. It's one of my favorite things in the world is traveling around the world, documenting these extreme places and then showing these spots to the world, because most people don't want to go into these situations or can't, but they love watching it. They love seeing the beauty and the power of Mother Nature.
Yeah, you've been in some pretty amazing places. You've gone down into volcanoes, for example.
Many times. That is one of my favorite things in the world to do, is to rappel down inside an active volcano.
So now, if people want to know about what they can do, I know that this series also, you know, is not just about telling people what's going on, but also about how they might be able to change it. Give us some perspective on that from your point of view.
Well, of course, the one thing, the biggest thing that people can do is to reduce their own carbon footprint. It starts at home. One thing that I'm very encouraged about is that the generation that is growing up now, the millennials and younger, are so in tune with these kind of issues. They embrace the idea of recycling and of reducing their consumption levels, and that I find very encouraging. One of the biggest things that a person can do, the easiest and the most impactful thing that a person can do in terms of the trade-off between effort versus impact, is to eat less meat. I'm not necessarily saying become a vegetarian, but especially red meat production is a very high contributor to greenhouse gases. And by eating less meat, it makes a big difference with very little effort on your part.
Well, that's great. Well, it's just been great to talk with you, George Coronis. Your new editions of the Angry Planet series, which is being revived, is happening now, is going to be on, it's on KCET, KCET Link. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, and I look forward to watching those episodes.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
George Coronis. Go to writersvoice.net to watch episode 1 of the new season of Angry Planet, Rising Oceans. We just have a moment left for me to tell you about a lovely new collection of quotes about nature. It's called appropriately the Nature Lover's Quotation Book, an inspired collection for hiking, camping, and the great outdoors. It's out from Hatherley Press. Let's dip into it for a sample. Here's one from an author we've had on the show before, nature writer Gretel Ehrlich. A tree is an aerial garden, a botanical migration from the sea, from those earliest plants, the seaweeds. It is a purchase on crumbled rock, on ground. The human, standing, is only a different upsweep and articulation of cells. How tree-like we are, how human, the tree.
Slowly, slowly, they return to the small woodland, let alone great trees outspreading and upright apostles of the patient as stars, they build in air, tier after tier of timbered choir, stout beams upholding weightless grace of song, a blessing on this place. They stand
one from John Muir, the great explorer and conservationist of the West. When we contemplate the whole globe as one great dewdrop, striped and dotted with continents and islands, flying through space with other stars all singing and shining together as one, the whole universe appears as an infinite storm of beauty. And those were two quotations from the Nature Lover's Quotation Book, an inspired collection for hiking, camping, and the great outdoors. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.